Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Blackest Light. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. Like many of my British and American brothers and sisters, I am sadly ignorant to other world languages. So in advance of tonight's episode, which takes place in mainland Europe, I apologize for my poor delivery of names and places, which I'm sure I will embarrass myself in trying to say, and duly butcher their pronunciation. Once again, my sincere apologies in advance for this, but I will try my very best.
Is this a ridiculous notion, or is Satan rampant in rock? To some, the answer is obvious. Skull-headed monsters and demon-like figures are probably the most blatant. Then, there is the upside-down cross, depicting a mockery of Jesus Christ. There is, of course, the sign of Satan. And there is the number 666.
His mother says he was a normal, happy boy until he became obsessed with black metal music.
It's been associated with satanic worship, suicide, and animal sacrifice. But is death metal music just hype or something that could actually hurt your kids?
Certain kinds of musical expressions have the potential to serve as a medium for evil spirits to work through.
I mean, we all know that adolescence is a tough time, but it's amazing to see the lengths people go to express their frustration. It's sad.
It's amazing, but I think parents have to really pay more attention to what these kids are listening to.
We are all humans. Every decision we choose directly impacts our mortality in one way or another. Picture it within your head. Because of our consciousness, we are confronted by the paradox that we have an inherent desire to avoid death. Yet at the same time, we are also intellectually aware that preventing it is ultimately impossible. We choose to live with this reality in the back of our minds, buried deep with childhood trauma and difficulties of self. But occasionally, in our actions, thoughts and vocalizations, it bubbles to the surface, but only for a minute. Our culture denies it, even though we are constantly surrounded by it. We unknowingly embrace its shape and brutal reality. In Western society, we live as if death doesn't exist, as if we will live forever, living fast lives of ignorance. We are inconvenienced by death, as if it interferes with our pleasures, consumerism, and our bourgeois careers. It's a finality that we are almost ill-equipped to handle, unable to process or perceive. A person's own death is something that deeply scares them. Their final fears and their grieving reactions are overpowering when someone close to them dies. It's almost part self-acknowledgement of their own mortality. Crestfallen. Death is a loss, not a peaceful transition. But contrary to those who fear death, others embrace it. And perhaps the most bizarre of all are those who believe that they are already dead. Our story begins in the quiet town of Västerhaninge in Stockholm County, Sweden, in January of 1969. It was there that a boy named Per Yngve Olin was born to parents Anita Farsberg and Lars Olin. They divorced soon after Per Yngve's birth. Even from an early age, Olin was an interesting character. He suffered an internal bleeding injury when his spleen ruptured due to what he claimed was an ice skating accident. But Olin was hiding something that his brother later clarified. The injury he suffered was not caused by an ice skating accident, but it was actually caused by a brutal beating that he received at the hands of bullies. Olin's life was characterized by displays of hierarchical dominance, something of a theme that will continue throughout his life and the course of our story tonight. Because of the injury to his stomach, by bullies, Per Yngve had to be taken to hospital where he was briefly declared clinically dead due to the severity of his condition. The event was traumatic, leading to Olin developing an unhealthy obsession with death. He became utterly obsessed with the notion that he had been declared dead. He began to see himself as dead. It changed his worldview and perception of things. And as time went on, he became increasingly depressed and introverted because of it. It was the mid-1980s, and many who were around him speculated that he began to suffer from a rare mental illness called walking corpse syndrome, in which the sufferer believes that they are dead and are putrefying in the physical world. Alongside his obsession with death, Olin also developed a taste for heavy metal and rock music. It went hand in hand with his dark character. He cited Motorhead, Venom, and Metallica as some of his early influences and favourite artists at the time. Olin decided that he enjoyed metal music so much that he wanted to become a vocalist in a death metal band. So he founded one, the Swedish death metal group, which he named Morbid. Olin derived his musical persona from his fascination with death and now embodied it to its fullest extent. He went to extreme lengths to create the image and atmosphere that he wanted in his performance. He lived the image and personification of walking death. At the very beginning of his musical career, Olin began wearing corpse paint, which involved covering his face with black and white makeup, creating a theatrical yet morbid image. He would bury his clothes in his backyard for a few days, then dig them up prior to performances to complete his rotting look. This extreme dedication to his obsession with death and his macabre performance image would gain instant attention and notoriety among the metal scene at the time. At the same time, around 500 kilometers or 310 miles away in Langhus, Norway, another band named Mayhem had just completed recording their first EP, titled Death Crush. Mayhem was led by their guitarist, Øystein Aarseth, who chose the name and became better known as Euronymous. Euronymous was a provocative figure, the complete package from head to toe, and was extremely controversial. He wore all black clothes, dyed his hair jet black, and always spoke in a deadly serious and commanding tone. He presented himself as the leader of a militant movement, a death cult, with the goal of spreading hatred, sorrow, and evil. He was a person of strong beliefs and conviction. Euronymous stated that he opposed individualism, compassion, peace, and happiness of any kind. He was interested in totalitarian communist states, like the Stalinist Soviet Union, because, as he said, that communism was extreme. Whilst Euronymous was not a Nazi, his beliefs did fall into racist and fascist ideology. Friends of Euronymous, however, argued that the intense image he projected did not reflect his true personality, and that it was just an image that he put out to the world. While he was with his peers, Euronymous displayed a much more gentle attitude and behaviours compared to the aggressive imagery that he used to scare people for effect. Euronymous and his fellow bandmates released Death Crush on his newly founded independent record label, Poser Corpse Music. The initial 1,000 copy release quickly sold out. Among those who successfully got their hands on the record was Per Yngve Olin. He was becoming dissatisfied with his own band, Morbid, and upon learning that Mayhem's current vocalist had departed the band, Olin decided to contact them. Mayhem received a small package from Olin containing a demo tape, a letter detailing his ideas for the future of Mayhem, and a crucified mouse. After hearing of Olin's extreme style, Jon Stubberud, who went by the name Necro Butcher and Euronymous, contacted him right away. Olin moved to Norway to become the vocalist of Mayhem, and like his new bandmates, Olin took a stage name that fit his personality perfectly. From then on, Per Yngwie was known as Dead, quite simply because of his obsession with death and being the living dead. With Euronymous and Dead's extreme personalities and image, they would begin to push each other to further extremes. This would result in the birth of a new genre of music in Norway, along with this extreme and dark genre of music, which became known as Norwegian black metal. A destructive reputation and a sinister series of events would soon follow. What would develop would be one of the most shockingly violent stories to emerge in the 1990s, and one which would involve betrayal, arson, and a lethal struggle for power. Mayhem had noticed the direction in which metal was moving within the United States. The States was considered the home of thrash metal and death metal at the time, which itself had evolved from the British rock music scene of the 1960s and 70s. But Mayhem were dismayed at how trendy and suburban it had become in America. Their music was called death metal, and Mayhem thought that these bands had a message. And that message, and what they were saying, wasn't pretty. Death metal is a music that is boundaryless. You can be as heavy, as dark, and as controversial as you want. You can be as sick as you want. Death metal is taking something a step further, and Mayhem were invested deeply within that ideology. But death metal in the United States began to grow its audience in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when bands such as Cannibal Corpse, Obituary, and Morbid Angel shaped the genre with their album covers, dark lyrics, and merchandise. These bands displayed provocative illustrations of grotesque images to shock fans and critics alike. However, and by contrast to their music, bands in the United States death metal scene typically led fairly ordinary and non-violent suburban lives, separating the art from the artist, keeping the art on stage, and maintaining a separation from the extreme. In Norway, however, Mayhem and the growing black metal scene felt that the genre had become too corporate and colourful, that there should be no separation, that you should live what you preach. Mayhem's disdain for the commercialisation of death metal coincided with the world's shift towards global Americanization after the end of the Soviet Union and fall of the Berlin Wall. As American culture influenced other countries outside of the continental United States, their media, cuisine, and popular culture began to change dramatically. Many people in some mainland European countries felt angered by these changes and wanted to preserve their own national and cultural heritage. The Norwegian black metal scene would be one of those manifestations and the reactions to these changes. To them, metal symbolizes death, darkness, and all the aspects of humanity that society tried to hide. Those who held this belief argued that the death metal scene that had developed in the United States was fake and was distorting the meaning of the genre. Vocalist and musician Fenriz of black metal band Dark Throne stated, quote,
"I mean, when death metal turned ugly was when within the subculture fans were starting to wear shorts and sneakers and stuff like that. They played good old death metal, yeah, but they looked like surfers, you know? That's when we put our fucking foot down. We wanted to have none of that."
The Norwegian black metal scene and the musicians therein felt that the true nature of heavy metal subculture was in need of restoration. It needed saving from corporate America. They needed to ensure that death metal would not end up being sponsored by Disney or McDonald's and slapped on a fucking Happy Meal box. With Dead as their new frontman, Mayhem was at the forefront of this emerging movement. After Dead moved to Norway to join Mayhem, the newly structured band began writing songs for their new album. The lyrics shifted to a noticeably more darker tone, reflecting Dead's grim outlook. This focused on death and suicide primarily. In addition, Euronymous developed a significantly more harsh and dissonant guitar style that still influences the black metal genre to this day. Things didn't go very well for Mayhem as they began touring with a new lineup, however. Shows were being cancelled, with many venues refusing to let them play, refusing to pay money for such extreme music and imagery, refusing to let fans of this music into their venues. And also, the local police often shut down the shows. Things were chaotic. During one gig, Dead found a decomposing crow in the street outside of the venue, and he put it in a plastic bag and carried it around with him so that he could smell it before going on stage. This was so he could sing with the stench of death in his nostrils, he said. This quickly became a ritual, with Dead killing birds in advance of shows and carrying them with him to the venues. Dead developed a unique and somewhat repugnant personal odour due to this. In many ways, their first tour was a disaster, and when they returned to Norway, tensions had got very high, especially between Dead and Euronymous. After moving to a new house in the woods near Krakstad, the band's situation took a strange and darker turn. A long period of inactivity plagued the band. This took a toll on Dead's mood and fragile mental health. Both he and Euronymous also became irritated with one another after having lived together for some time. Dead's social circumstances and fascination with death and the macabre deepened. His mental state deteriorated further, and he spent much of his time writing letters and drawing. He sat alone in his room, inside his own head, allowing his depression to fester and plunge to its darkest depths. Mayhem's drummer, Hellhammer, stated that Dead became unresponsive and switched off at this time, and the world had become completely alien to him. Many of Dead's friends were upset by this and concerned for the developments in his health and his declining state. Euronymous, however, became intrigued by Dead's self-destructive behaviour. Despite the fact that he might be a danger to himself, Euronymous was instead interested in how Dead's declination played out. Euronymous encouraged Dead's negative thoughts because he perceived the extreme negativity as fitting with Mayhem's image. He placed the art before self-preservation or care of his friend. In April 1991, Euronymous left the house, but he had forgotten his house keys. When he returned, he found that he couldn't enter. After shouting through the front door and mail slot, Euronymous came to the conclusion that no one else was at home either, so he would have to enter through a window. Given how the members of the band almost never left the house, and in fact had not left the house in months, this should have raised questions in Euronymous's mind, but for whatever reason it didn't. The only open window was in Dead's room, so he climbed up and jumped through into the house. Euronymous was met with a horrifying sight. The 22-year-old Per Yngve Olin, Dead, had killed himself with a shotgun blast to the head while alone in the house. But rather than immediately calling the police, Euronymous saw this as an opportunity. He rushed back out and bought several disposable cameras from a nearby store and returned to photograph Dead's body. He also rearranged the body and items around it, adding a knife and moving the shotgun into view. Euronymous would use the now infamous photographs for the cover of Mayhem's next album, titled Dawn of the Black Hearts. The photograph is extremely graphic, as you can imagine. I won't post it on our social media or host the image on our website. However, for those of you who need to see it, the image is on Google if you search for it. As it was used for an album cover, it's sadly widely available within the public domain. Euronymous also collected fragments of Dead skull to make necklaces, which he would hand out to musicians in the black metal scene who he deemed worthy. Dead had struggled his whole life with depression and suicidal ideation, and unfortunately he couldn't hold on any longer to the pain and succumbed to the temptation on the 8th of April, 1991. A rift soon developed between Euronymous and his bandmates, due, for the most part, to how he treated Dead before and after his suicide. Bassist Necro Butcher left the band and immediately ended his friendship with Euronymous. Mayhem was once again on hiatus. But it was far, far from over. The death of Dead sparked a barrage of media interest in the black metal scene, and what happened to Dead would be the first in a series of infamous events that would follow.
To ban a form of music they say has disturbing satanic overtones. It's called black metal music and encourages devil worship and the desecration of churches. The campaign follows the jailing of four young men in Kent for causing more than £100,000 of damage to graveyards. Jonathan Beale has this special report.
This is the type of music believed to be responsible for a wave of attacks on churches in Northern Europe. Called black metal music, it's overtly anti-Christian and synonymous with satanic worship. This church in Bergen, Norway, was burned to the ground. In all, 13 Norwegian churches have suffered a similar fate. Now, many fear that black metal music has taken a grip over here. Earlier this month, four young followers in Tunbridge Wells were jailed for causing £100,000 worth of damage to cemeteries and churches in the area. One of them, 18-year-old Paul Timms, is serving 30 months in a young offenders institute. His mother says he was a normal, happy boy until he became obsessed with black metal music.
They become almost absorbed in it. It is a driving force. They have to have it. I hate it so much that I've seen what it's done to our family on a personal level. And I want to see it banned. I want to see it off the face of the earth.
The CD and record covers of black metal music are littered with pagan symbols. Bands call themselves names such as Mayhem, Dark Throne, and Cradle of Filth. The lyrics are often difficult to make out, but often carry a sinister message. Now, one Tunbridge Wells vicar who's lectured on the dangers of the occult has joined the campaign to ban black metal music.
When I heard it, almost a cold shiver goes down your spine, and you think, what is all this about? And what disturbs me is, how is it possible that four boys from a decent, ordinary society with a Christian background, parents of two of the boys, committed Christians, and I say, what on earth went wrong? Now, if it can happen to these sort of chaps, well, goodness knows, what's going to happen to even more vulnerable people?
It's not just the music that's causing so much concern, but the image and lifestyles of the bands themselves. One member of the Norwegian group Emperor, seen here performing in the UK last year, has confessed to arson and burglary. Another has been charged with murdering a gay man. But those who promote black metal music in this country deny they're promoting crime.
There's nothing in the lyrics to pertain to people that they should go out and commit any acts of against Christians or against anyone else. It has got satanic connotations, but I think it attracts people who are into extremes anyway. These are the sort of people who'd read horror books or be into true crime stuff. You can't ban it because it'll just go underground and probably get a lot worse.
If we have censorship on films and television, have we ever realized that we might come to a time when we have to have censorship in music?
Black metal music can be bought at many record shops carrying no warning, but Veronica Timms believes the music must be banned. Without that, she fears her son will not be the last to be sucked into committing sacrilege, and black metal music will leave its ugly mark in this country, just as it has in Norway.
In June 1991, following Dead's passing, Euronymous opened a record store in Oslo named Helvete. Translated to English, it meant simply, Hell. Helvete also housed the independent record label that Euronymous had started and released the Mayhem album under. The record store's walls were painted black and decorated with medieval weapons, posters of bands, and picture discs. After Helvete opened, many young musicians became obsessed with Euronymous, his ideas, and the mystery surrounding Mayhem. He developed a cult following, and his image and notoriety grew to huge levels. The Norwegian black metal scene was growing, and many musicians often congregated at the record shop and hung out in its basement. The metalheads which gathered at Helvete referred to themselves as the Black Circle. They considered themselves as being atop of the black metal scene hierarchy. As media interest in the scene grew, Euronymous described the Black Circle as a cult, a group of militant Satanists whose activities were funded by his record store. They looked down upon most others, including those within the black metal scene, whom they deemed began and ended with them. But some of Euronymous's friends claimed that the Black Circle was exaggerated and that he made up the rumors. He made these up because he wanted people to believe that he and Mayhem were more extreme than they actually were. The truth, however, was somewhere in between. It was common for Euronymous to engage in this kind of attention-seeking behavior. He would often take advantage of any catastrophe to make a name for himself and for Mayhem. Due to Euronymous's influence on the underground black metal scene, he became well known and acquainted to many musicians. This was convenient for Euronymous, as he was in need of a bassist for Mayhem since Necro Butcher had left. It wouldn't be long before he met someone just as extreme as he, if not more so.
My name is Volker Gevika, and I play in Brooklyn. The guy I killed intended to kill me, so I killed him before he managed to kill me. He tried, but he failed miserably.
Euronymous met Varg Vikernes, a fellow black metal musician who played in the one-man band named Burzum in mid-1991. Many people in the scene exhibited extreme tendencies, offensive opinions, and dark behavior, but Varg took things to a whole new level. Varg argued that Christianity and modern culture had stripped Norway of its traditions and heritage. His pagan beliefs and commitment to nationalism significantly shaped his worldview. He supported Nazism and white supremacy. He was devoid of any positivity. When Varg was young, his mother worked for an oil company, and his father was an electric engineer. The family moved to Baghdad in Iraq when he was 6 years old, because his father was working on a computer program for Saddam Hussein. Since the Baghdad English school had no openings, Varg had to attend an Iraqi elementary school. It was this early in his life that he started to develop extreme views due to his differences from his classmates. According to Varg's mother, his reactions to situations were very strong, and he wasn't very good at managing his emotions in certain conditions. As Varg became involved in the Norwegian music scene later in his life, his emotional instability became very apparent. Varg began playing guitar as a young teenager, and he quickly became interested in death metal. Then he discovered Norwegian black metal, and he never looked back. But no one knew who he was. Even though Varg held a high opinion of himself, he needed other people to realize this too. He came onto the scene and quickly began talking about his new band, Burzum. He quickly recorded his band's first album, and Euronymous became enamored by it. The two became fast friends, and close very quickly. Euronymous took Varg, who was 5 years younger than him, under his wing for all intents and purposes. He signed Burzum to his record label, and invited Varg to play bass for Mayhem too. Varg wasn't keen to be Euronymous's protege, however, and views himself already as an equal to him. This developed into an unspoken competition between the two to see who could be the most evil, as their friendship quickly turned into a rivalry. Varg had these comments to make about Euronymous at the time. Quote,
"Several people started to dislike him because he gave them the impression that he was organizing all of it. That's what that was. what he wanted it to look like. He started to talk about this black metal mob, and he wanted to look as if he was some godfather of some evil organization. And he said that in interviews, and for a while we went along with it for fun. But of course, to him, it was dead serious in the sense that he wanted to be. He wanted to be like, you know, he wanted it to be a mob sort of organization. But of course, the others didn't, and so of course, everything falls apart. He can't be a mob all by himself, can he?
Varg's jealousy of Euronymous and his control over the scene became apparent to those within the Black Circle. Being the most anti-establishment, sadistic and anti-social was crucial to gaining respect within the black metal scene. This was an extremely challenging, tight situation for Euronymous, who was essentially fame-hungry and needed the notoriety, which of course clashed with what he wanted the notoriety for. Euronymous was all bark and no bite, observers claimed. Varg's involvement in the black metal circle led the social group to believe that any conflict between Varg and Euronymous would almost certainly result in one of them killing the other. There was a nervous peace amongst the group. The extreme nature of black metal was generating a large amount of media interest, and the scene was gaining a notoriety. However, in Varg's view, unless more serious actions were taken in the real world, then the movement would appear to be nothing more than empty rhetoric, another silly theatrical music genre. He felt that people's actions must demonstrate what they believed. Varg believed that black metal would have to prove it wasn't a joke, and he took it upon himself to do just that. With the aim of gaining power over Euronymous and to prove the seriousness of the black metal scene, Varg set fire to the Fantoft Stave Church in Bergen, Norway. The church was built in 1170 and had stood through wars, battles and tumultuous times undamaged for more than 800 years. Initially, authorities believed the fire was caused by a lightning strike or an electrical failure. However, the fire was no accident. The national news headlines in Norway and Northern Europe were filled with reports of the destruction of a cultural landmark, yet no one had taken responsibility for the arson. If the destruction was meant to be a statement or a message, then it was unknown to the public what that message was meant to be. Further churches were burned, and Varg boasted to his friends within the Black Circle that he would never be caught because of the respect and power that he had now gained in the Norwegian black metal scene. A foolish boast, perhaps. But according to Varg, the authority he had gained within the group prevented anyone from exposing him. He claimed he had unrivaled power, and he was now overwhelmingly in control of the black metal scene. These comments and behaviors cast a strange light on Euronymous, because he had not yet taken part in the destruction. But to demonstrate that he was capable of being more than just a spectator, Euronymous participated in the burnings alongside Varg. It was clear to many that the competition between the two was escalating to new heights and was causing tensions to increase to breaking point. In an attempt to spread fear, promote black metal and draw more customers to the record shop, Euronymous planned to have Varg be interviewed about the church burnings. During the interview, Varg went by his pseudonym Count Giznash to maintain anonymity. The journalists were summoned to an apartment and allegedly warned that they would be killed if the police were called to the location. Varg and his companions told the journalists that they had burned the churches and warned that the attacks would continue. In their statement, they claimed to be devil worshippers and said that their purpose was to spread fear and evil throughout Europe. Varg shared details with the journalists who were told about the arsons that hadn't yet been released to the public. The journalists thus contacted the police to confirm this information. Prior to publishing the article, the police confirmed all of the shared details, and the article was printed on the front page of a national newspaper with the headline, quote, "We set the churches on fire." Beneath the headline was a photo of Varg. Although by the time the article was printed, Varg had already been arrested. The newspaper brought black metal into the media spotlight once again, just as Euronymous had hoped. But rather than enjoy the fame, Euronymous decided to close his record store down, as it began to draw the attention of both police and the wider media. Varg criticized Euronymous for closing the shop down rather than taking advantage of the publicity. Since Euronymous failed to take advantage of the attention, Varg believed his 6 weeks in custody were a complete waste of time. This only caused the animosity between the two to reach breaking. In the summer of 1993, the power struggle between Euronymous and Varg took a turn for the worst. The hostility between the two had gone beyond rivalry. The two were having disputes about record contracts, as well as their struggle for dominance over the black metal scene. Varg was told about an alleged plan created by Euronymous to torture him to death with an electroshock weapon, and videotaping the incident to share amongst the black circle to regain full dominance. The plot would have Euronymous call a meeting about an unsigned contract as a pretext. The plan had been shared by Euronymous to only a select group of close friends, one of whom informed Varg on August the 10th, 1993. Varg was infuriated by the news of this plot. He and his bandmate Blackthorn travelled from Bergen to Euronymous's apartment in Oslo to confront him. Once they arrived, Varg walked up to Euronymous's door on the fourth floor, while Blackthorn stood in the stairwell smoking. Upon Varg's entry, a confrontation erupted. By Varg's account, he handed Euronymous the signed agreement at the door. Then he confronted Euronymous about the alleged plot to torture him. Euronymous reacted by kicking Varg in the chest. A struggle ensued, but their turbulent relationship would very quickly come to an end when Varg would fatally stab Euronymous during the encounter, leaving his body where he died. Immediately following the murder, Varg and Blackthorn drove the 600 kilometers back to Bergen, throwing away Varg's blood-stained clothes at a lake on the way back. The body was later found on the first floor. Euronymous had been stabbed 23 times, twice in the head, 5 times in the neck, and 16 times to the back. Varg was arrested on the 19th of August 1993 in Bergen. His trial began nearly a year later, and many other Norwegian black metal scene members would also be put on trial. Varg Vikernes was sentenced to Norway's maximum penalty for the murder of Euronymous, the arson of 3 churches, and the theft of 150 kilograms of explosives. As the judge handed down the 21-year sentence on Vikernes, he smirked to those in attendance. We will never know for sure if what Varg claims caused the murder of Euronymous was true. We don't know if the plot by Euronymous to torture Varg was genuine, or a lie created by Varg as justification, at least in his mind, to kill his arch nemesis. We don't know if Euronymous attacked Varg first. But what is certain is the 23 stab wounds to Euronymous and his body laying 3 floors below his apartment makes it clear the rage that Varg spewed onto him. The hatred that Varg had internalized for so long had reached the surface. The story of mayhem, Norwegian black metal, and the church burnings of the early 1990s demonstrates the social dynamics of dominance in an influential and powerful organization or group. What occurred within mayhem was akin to a Greek tragedy, or the petty jealousy of a mundane soap opera. The combination of toxic power dynamics, male dominance, and the shift in global politics created a perfect storm for the events that unfolded. Yet we see them every day in social and business situations. The band have split up due to musical differences is as cliché as it is commonplace. Control and those of us who need it in some degree often plunge ourselves to levels of depravity in order to cling on to it or gain more. From the smallest areas of culture and society, right up to the highest levels of business, government, and global geopolitics, core human characteristics and psychological makeups are undeniable and often uncontrollable. As a species, even humans have behaviors and psychological wants and needs that they cannot ignore or control. No matter how sophisticated, intelligent, and above the animal kingdom we like to believe that we are. Sure, we can bury our feelings, we can store our trauma, and push down our driving needs, but ultimately that only causes further damage to our psyches, which can manifest themselves further down the line. Death leaves a profound imprint on a person's mindset that is unmatched by any other experiences of consciousness. It is through stories such as these that society is able to gain a glimpse of what our elaborate social constructions try so desperately to conceal from ourselves. On the 22nd of May 2009, Varg Vikernes was released from prison on probation. Since then, he has married and moved to Corrèze, France. His views remain controversial and white supremacist in ideation. His YouTube channel was removed by the website in 2018 for spreading racial hatred. Both Varg and Euronymous were victims of their own hate. The thing they coveted the most was the very thing that would destroy them. An adolescent and arrogant mindset of immature bitterness to the world and a righteous self-importance ultimately caused their own destruction and internal rot. I'll leave you with some words by Vikernes about his relationship with Euronymous and his arrest for the church burnings. There is nothing offensive in this 2016 interview, but it allows you to gain some understanding of who he is. Good night, everyone.
The year is 1993, and all of a sudden, one day, black metal becomes world famous. What happened? Let's find out. During the year 1992, Euronymous was running his shop into the ditch. He was supposed to have a record company and his shop and run it, but he was a terrible businessman. And when he released my debut album, the Burzum debut album, he had to ask me for the money to afford it. And when he sold out all his all the copies, and he did quite fast. I think it was printed in 1,000, maybe 500 even. 500 CDs and 500 LPs. Anyway, when he had sold everything out, he didn't have the money to print more. So months went by, and as a musician, to me that was rather frustrating. So I visited his shop quite often to, you know, try to help him run his business. I mean, he was so incompetent he didn't even manage to go to the post office and collect, you know, packages with albums that he was supposed to sell in his shop, because, you know, he didn't have a car. And the gods forbid, you know, taking the bus or walking would be too hard, I guess. So I visited him and I drove him to the post office. I tried everything I could to help him. And eventually I kind of gave up. So I wanted to start my own record company and just release my music myself. He didn't like it very much. And in one conversation I had with him on the phone, he told me that he wanted me to do something to, you know, help his business. And I told him that I could arrange an interview with some guys I knew, and he didn't want to do it himself, but he was very eager to have me do it. And I thought, well, okay, I'll just do it anonymous and talk about his shop, and it would help his business, because he didn't have enough customers. So I did. Talked with a Christian journalist in Bergens Tidende, a newspaper in Norway. And the guy was a complete nutcase. I didn't know at the time, of course. He was Christian. And his intent was, of course, to prove the existence of Satanists in Norway. And I was I was, at the time, I think I was 19 years old, and I had this fuck you attitude. So I didn't give a shit, and I just exaggerated and had fun with him, really. And connected it all, of course, to black metal and his shop in Oslo. Helvete. And the journalist left. He wanted to check my claims with the police and so forth, because all of this was linked to church burnings and everything. And of course, my idea was that if the cops came and wanted to ask me about the church burnings, all I could do was to say that, hey, I talked to the journalist to mock him. I pulled his leg. I haven't done anything. Nobody I know have done anything. Bye-bye. And that would be it. Which, of course, is true. Had people in the scene had a brain. But, of course, they didn't. But, anyway, he called the police. And he was supposed to call me and run the story through the phone. Tell me the story through the phone, and I would be able to confirm it or not. And he called me. And I said, well, that's not what I told you. He was completely out of his mind. And that's not the story. You know, that's bullshit. You didn't even mention the shop in Oslo. That was the whole point, after all. And he said, okay, I'll change the story and I'll call you later. And then 10 minutes later, the cops came at my door. He had called the cops. And they arrested me. Instead of questioning me, like, do you know anything about this? And I would say, no. They arrested me. Okay. And then he ran his story. Not the story, the real story, but the story he had produced, based on what I had talked to him about. And then the cops asked me, did you give an interview to this or that guy yesterday? And I said, yes. And then the newspaper wrote that I had confirmed the story. Not that I had confirmed that I had talked to him, but I had confirmed his story. Then the police sent me to jail, custody, where they were not... I was not allowed to talk to anybody. So the journalist, for 3 weeks, three whole weeks, he was allowed to push his agenda without anyone questioning it, because nobody were able to. The only person able to was me, and I was in prison, not allowed to talk. So the whole story was just complete bullshit. And but the good thing is, of course, that eventually the story about also the Euronymous shop came up. And then, amazingly, which is so incredibly idiotic, he closed his shop because the attention was too uncomfortable for his family. And so I sat weeks in prison for nothing. He closed his shop rather than use this opportunity, which was the whole purpose to begin with. And he was in on it. He had asked me to do it. He closed his shop because his parents thought it was too uncomfortable for his family. You know, the attention wasn't comfortable. And during my incarceration, they took all my clothes, of course, and I was supposed to go to court and argue to get out. And the police, this is, I talk about this because I always have this comments from people who say that, yeah, you wore Venom t-shirts, you were a Venom fan. I never was. The fact is that I sold Venom t-shirts in Bergen to, you know, to make a living. And I had a whole box of Venom shirts and some other shirts for that sake. And the police went to my apartment to get some clothes for me because they had taken everything I had. And of these clothes, of the clothes they took and brought to me, were some of these Venom shirts. There were some other idiotic death metal bands. But the Venom shirt had black metal on it, and it was the image on Orset's shop. You know, the front door had this very image. So, of course, I thought, yes, I'm going to wear that T-shirt, you know, to promote the shop. Because at the time, I didn't know that he had wimped out completely, pussied out like complete chicken, and closed his shop. So I didn't know that at the time. So I took this t-shirt on, not because I liked Venom. I hated Venom. I never liked Venom. I still think it sucks. But because it had black metal on it, and it, because it was the image that Ozzet had on his front door in the shop. In court, I explained to the judge what had happened, and that I had just pulled the journalist's leg, and that there was no problem, really. I had nothing to do with any of these church fires. And, of course, he had a brain. He reasoned, so he thought, said that, OK, that makes sense. Bye-bye, you can go. And that was it. The whole case just crumbled. Bam! There was no evidence. It was just bullshit. Of course, the guys in the scene who had burned churches, including Euronymous, they were really scared, but of course for no reason. Why would they be scared? If you burn a church, how are they going to prove it? So they were, some of them were questioned by the police, but of course, nothing happened. Nobody were persecuted. Nothing. Everybody could just go home. No, they weren't, no, nobody were even arrested except me. So that was it. Nothing happened. This was not the reason why anybody were arrested. And Euronymous lost so much face because he's supposed to be this cool, hard, black metaler. And he crumbled to pressure from his parents and closed his shop when this happened. Everybody in the scene were just laughing at him because, you know, what a fucking loser. And this is one of the reasons why Euronymous started to really, really hate me. The first reason was that I started my own record company. The second reason is that everybody started to laugh at him because of this case, and rightfully so. The third reason was that in the aftermath of this, when I was released from prison, everybody wanted to talk to me and not to him. And previously, he had been this big, important figure in the black metal scene. But now, all of a sudden, they called him to talk to me. They wanted to talk to me. To me, this was... I wasn't interested in attention. The whole interview was made anonymous. And when they exposed me with my real name, I thought that this was uncomfortable. I didn't like it. But he wanted to be this black metal, famous black metal person. So when they wanted to talk to me instead of him, it was a... he was very jealous. And this was the third reason that he started to really, really hate me. The fourth reason is, of course, political differences. But that's really not that important in this context. The real reasons were... I started a company of my own because he was useless. And I exposed him as a complete pussy by giving that interview. Or rather, he exposed himself. Or my actions led to him exposing himself. And thirdly, the journalists wanted to talk to me, not him. He was an attention whore. He wanted all the attention. And he didn't get it. I did. So... All in all, this was the incident, the one single incident that made black metal world famous. Kind of strange, isn't it?
One final note from me tonight. Our Patreon page is now live. After a legal challenge by an unnamed organization, we had to make our page live to enable us to release certain subjects behind a paywall. We still release free episodes as often as we can on all podcast platforms, but we also now have a Patreon page where we can release more controversial episodes on a weekly basis. It costs just $2 a month to join. It's the cheapest we were able to make it. But it costs less than a cup of coffee for at least 4 extra episodes a month, access to exclusive merch, and blogs written by myself and my team. That's a hell of a bargain. Our first 2 exclusive episodes are up there now. including the one we were forced to remove from streaming platforms. If you'd like to join us, we're over at www.patreon.com/deadsouls. Good night.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.